was January the 24th, right? 1990 in Huntsville, Alabama, interview of Walt Weisman by Michael Neufeld. I guess I've gotten all the important information. The way we start this thing normally is just to get a little biography leading up to this. Mm-hmm. So your original German name is Walter Weisman.
Weisman, with an E in the middle and a double N.
Two N's, right. Yeah. And your birth date?
August 30, 1920.
And birthplace?
Dortmund, West Germany, in mm-hmm. state of Westphalia.
Mm-hmm. Now West Germany, that
yeah.
time.
Yeah.
That time is in Prussia.
My wife's from the same city.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah.
So, and your parents' occupations?
Well, my father was a very skilled cabinet maker.
Mm-hmm.
He, like many people in his age group, got caught, so to speak, in the First World War
mm-hmm.
and was allowed to serve 4 years in the trenches.
Really?
And then had to regroup his life in the inflation and through depression and all this. See? So mm-hmm. he was born in 92,
mm-hmm. 1892.
Yeah, see. So you get an idea, he was in that age group. See?
Mm-hmm.
And Michael, I can't help, I have put my life into perspective through recent lectures and all, and it dawned on me, since I have spent only 25 years in Germany, and I'm mm-hmm. in my 45th year in the United States,
mm-hmm.
so it dawned on me, by the evaluating really the sequence of my first 25 years, that between the fact that I'm an immediate post-World War I baby, then inflation, French occupation
mm-hmm.
in that part of Germany,
right.
political turmoil, depression, dictatorship, World War II.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing normal in that sense
mm-hmm.
about my first 25 years. This is why I took to this country when I arrived in November of 45. In El Paso, I was in civic work within a year
mm-hmm.
because, especially with my interest in music and arts and entertainment, I had witnessed how a government can pay for such things but also eventually will tell you what the arts are all about
mm-hmm.
and allow you or not to enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
So I took, you might say, to the flip side of what I had brought as mm-hmm. a young man in experiences, and this is what got me into civic work so early,
mm-hmm.
to avoid having the government do the things that I had witnessed without even that time being old enough to fully understand the scope
mm-hmm.
of this kind of interference.
Mm-hmm. But you would say that in the Third Reich you had a sense of, that it was a dictatorship and that you were a little uncomfortable with that dictatorship?
No, I tell you why. You see, when Hitler took over, I was 12.
Yeah.
I did not have enough knowledge of history,
mm-hmm.
of any other form of government due to the age.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the war started, I turned 19 that week
yeah.
and became a soldier soon thereafter. So I had a void of understanding.
Yeah.
See, you can only, as you well know, compare to have judgment.
Right.
And I had nothing to bounce this experience against.
Mm-hmm.
See, it just dawned on me later, even during the war. You see, there was one feature about Peenemünde. It was a fairly liberal outfit.
Mm-hmm.
And the scuttlebutt and the listening to Radio London and all mm-hmm. was not, I mean, privately, was not an unusual thing. And when you begin to realize later how your contractors are eliminated due to air raids and the government pronounces the glorious victories, you can't help starting to think. This is, mm-hmm. of course, the mind of 23, 24. You begin to wonder and have some doubts, see?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, it's quite an experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, as far as your father, I guess, would be described then as a master artisan,
yeah.
a small businessman.
He ended up, Michael, due to the inflation and turmoil, the political turmoil, spending 25 years as a technical man, a specialist in the municipal theater,
mm-hmm.
in the opera mostly,
wow.
see?
Mm-hmm.
So I grew up, so to speak, almost behind stage.
Really?
Due to having
background.
The privilege of being... So yeah, that stirred me up in many respects,
mm-hmm.
see? And then, of course, you know, that generation, I witnessed that, and again, I realized only later what World War I and the subsequent events had done to folks in my parents' age group, see?
Mm-hmm.
So that politically, as you well know, may have planted seeds for the future.
Mm-hmm.
See, that I couldn't at the time even recognize. See, maybe they didn't know themselves
mm-hmm.
what happened. See.
So did you complete gymnasium or
yeah.
its equivalent to Real?
I, however, you know, at the time, one had to go in the fourth grade to an entrance examination to even be accepted.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not the gymnasium, but Oberrealschule.
Mm-hmm.
And I was accepted. So in what would be our fifth grade, I started a six-year cycle at Oberrealschule
mm-hmm.
with the mandatory languages, the whole thing that we here miss out on,
yeah.
see, in general education. See? And I upset my principal teacher when I decided after 6 years to take that level, the Einjährige, mm-hmm. as it's called, instead of going to Abitur. Because our school had been picked some years back by one of the most progressive employers in Dortmund. This was the regional office of Deutsche Gasoline AG, the first and only synthetic gasoline factory.
Mm-hmm.
This was the regional office. And I had an enormous internship for 3 years
mm-hmm.
with rotation in the departments,
mm-hmm.
including introductions to the oil refinery
mm-hmm.
that belonged to the company, the port operations in Duisburg, where
mm-hmm.
I took the train for 90 days back and forth every day. And the advantages they paid for 2/3 of all my night school tuitions.
Mm-hmm.
So by the time I wasn't quite 19, I was probably better equipped for a professional life than having Abitur.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I had an intuition even then, bingo, the war started. Had I stayed in school for the Abitur, my age group was the first one to be allowed the Abitur in 8 years
mm-hmm.
instead of 9 due to the war. And everybody immediately became an officer's candidate.
Mm-hmm.
And very few of them came back. The damn war lasted too long. The buddy who sat with me on the same bench for 6 years, to this day still living in Dortmund. He was just a lieutenant, and he was kept in Russia until 1951.
Mm.
He returned a broken man. He even visited me here once. See? But I have had this so-called luck in life, the timing and things. And this is how I was drafted and got into situations after basic and after technical training. I ended up as an instructor at an Air Force communication school.
Mm-hmm.
The basic purpose of my and two other companies, military companies, was to train the ground operators for flight operations. In those days, there was no advanced radar and all this. It was still the old Q groups
mm-hmm.
in Morse code and all. And the after they went through certain basic technical training, we would have 90 days to bring out a new flock of these people for a minimum signal they had here
mm-hmm.
as to their level of competence.
You mean a badge that they
yeah,
were
on. Sort of, see?
Yeah.
And see, from there on, it was a coincidence I became not only an instructor, but there too, maybe my organizing ability, I became what was then called Unterrichtsleiter, meaning mm-hmm. the curriculum coordinator. It's sort of a head teacher, you might say. And it was corporal, big deal.
Wait, now, let me get a couple of details.
Yeah.
So you were drafted into the Luftwaffe?
Well, first 6 months Arbeitsdienst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the mandatory right. 6 months.
Okay, so you had the labor service.
Yeah, 6 months.
In the fall, that would have been the fall of 39?
No, I was drafted on March 1, 1940.
Okay.
And then in October 1940 went into the Luftwaffe,
mm-hmm.
into a communications training regiment.
Mm-hmm. Did you volunteer for that? Or
no,
you find
this
a
was
way
my draft age period.
You see. Just said this is what you'll be.
Yeah. So well, I had a preference in terms of communication,
mm-hmm.
see, but it I don't think it made much difference. It was just luck,
mm-hmm.
probably, that I got into that one, see.
Yeah,
and
you were not taken into a line.
The usual 90-day boot camp, see.
Mm-hmm.
And then transferred to additional technical training.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So somewhere around 1941, you became an instructor, approximately.
Yeah, I was still partly in preparation for flight training at a school where the onboard operators were trained. But my blood pressure got in the way.
Mm-hmm. Where was this?
Erfurt.
Mm-hmm. In Erfurt.
Erfurt. Bordfunkerschule. Mm-hmm. Bordfunker, you know, was the radio operator on board, see? But my blood pressure got in the way. Mm-hmm. So I was transferred to go to the ground operations, the counterpart to the Bordfunker, and this is where I ended up as teacher.
Mm-hmm. See? So you were taught in Erfurt for a couple of years? Or?
No, only less than 6 months. Mm-hmm. Because after I was written off for flight training, there was no space for me, obviously, see? Mm-hmm. So I ended up on the other island. Peenemünde is here, mm-hmm. and I ended up on the other island, the Luftnachrichtenschule Dievenow. Mm-hmm. Dievenow. Mm-hmm. See, and Peenemünde is on Usedom, and Dievenow is on the island of Wollin. See, you know the delta, the Oder Delta. See? Mm-hmm. And this is how I ended up without
that's
having.
That's farther to the east of Schwinemünde.
Yeah, in that neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And of course, you know, I had no idea at all that within hollering distance, mm-hmm. There was Peenemünde, see, so, mm-hmm. and I was picked, so to speak, again, it's one of those coincidences my life consists of, by Klaus Riedel, man well known to you. It was a coincidence, we ran into each other by sheer coincidence at a restaurant when I was waiting for a ship to take me back to my island. Mm-hmm. And he asked me what I was doing, and he was the wildest I had met, with the heavy leather coat, mm-hmm. and the first man who had ID cards from all three services. And I knew it was fishy. Mm-hmm. Found out later, he was the top gun, so to speak, mm-hmm. In terms of the imagination of Peenemünde. Mm-hmm. And within 90 days, I was transferred from that school as an enlisted specialist to Peenemünde.
Where did you bump into him?
In Swinemünde, mm-hmm. What happened is, once you had been in flight training, you still had to make an annual physical. Mm-hmm. And three of us were waiting to get back to our island that night after going through the physical. Mm-hmm. There was this bearded, stubbled civilian sitting at our table. Mm-hmm. And started talking to us, and we were bumping each other. Hey, what's it, this guy, you know? Mm-hmm. That was Klaus Riedel. Mm-hmm. So,
and that would have been in 43, probably?
Yeah, early 43, because mm-hmm. I was transferred. I arrived in Peenemünde on the 1st of May, 1943. Mm-hmm. See? And I found out then, Michael, my later explanation was something I observed almost throughout my 25 years in government. There was this highly advanced technical mission with top-level people, pitted against what I call an archaic administration, not blaming the people in the administration, but the methods, the systems, totally out of sync with the progressiveness and the flexibility needed to do very advanced technical work. I had no idea then, I wouldn't have been able to describe it, but the purpose, and I was designated by Wernher von Braun's deputy, who screened incoming specialists myself.
Was this Eberhard Reis?
No. At that time, he is the one who died during the air raid.
Ah, Walter Thiel.
Thiel, see? And he was sitting in the Air Force Commandant's office with my 201 file. And he points at me and he says, going through, and I wondered, what is this civilian doing with my 201 file? I had no mm-hmm. idea who he was. See, we were standing there before the Commandant. Mm-hmm. And he said, Lindenmeyer needs him. And Hans Lindenmeyer, a private yet in the Air Force, was looking for an administrative assistant who could relieve him and his group of 220 people, the so-called Armaturenlabor, which is really the valve laboratory. One of the most crucial points at the time, I found out later, due to the exotic fuels and chemicals and all, there was no precedent for even gaskets to take that kind of stuff, see? So Hans Lindenmeyer had his hands so full, and he was simply looking for someone who would take anything that was not directly related to the technical mission off his hands. Within 8 days, he said, look, you're on your own. If you need help, tell me. Otherwise, within less than 90 days after that, the air raid came. And Michael, I think, in a sense, you know, Sherman said war is hell. But I also learned that war creates the weirdest opportunity, whether one knows it at the time or not, whether it's in combat, in my case, through the crazy air raid on August 17, 1943. And we located that lab to a place called Anklam, A-N-K-L-A-M in Pomerania, in Pommern.
Yeah, I know where that is.
And the place was selected because there happened to be a huge air base with sufficient hangar and barrack space to accommodate our lab, because we were flattened in Peenemünde. There was no way.
The valve laboratory was particularly hit.
Well, it was one of the ones that were hit. And we started to rebuild, and I began to learn some of the weird intricacies when, for instance, in the process of rebuilding, through some contact in Amsterdam, American-made machine tools show up. Talking about a weird war, see? So you begin to think as a young man, say, wait a minute, what the hell goes on here, see? But you just get it going. Michael, within a year, we were flattened again in that same place. There was not one bomb outside the fence. It was all inside.
See, this was an American raid?
Oh, yeah. See, this was also the, and this is our, the air raid then was not, in my estimation, directed toward us. We were too small. But that whole air base was the principal logistics base for the entire 6th Air Fleet in Norway.
So that was this primary role at air base.
We just happened to be in that mess. We moved about 20 kilometers, 25, again to the south, to a place. Friedland, F-R-I-E-D-L-A-N-D, in Mecklenburg, in the state of Mecklenburg province. There was a vacant facility of the Department of Agriculture, a sufficiently large hall for us to get settled again with our precision machine tools and the design, and even to a modest degree, small test stands that we could get going. And then at the same time, a sister lab within the same directorate, the material testing lab, ended up in a place called Sadelkow, S-A-D-E-L-K-O-W, only maybe 15 miles away, because they had to be relocated. And administratively speaking then, the combination of the two was called Peenemünde 10. As an independent administrative operation. So while the technical bosses, of course, had their contact in Peenemünde, we were totally on our own in the management and administration, and only a daily courier, a driver, a PFC, and a sergeant, two very savvy characters. Even the food, we had to furnish food and everything. There was nothing to be had. And that ended up then with the decision that you're well aware of, of late 1944, to move the entire operation to the west.
Okay, now I want to stop you and go back over a couple of things. When you went to Peenemünde in 43, you were officially assigned to this paper unit, Flakversuchsstelle.
That was my place, and the commandant, I don't know whether the name has ever been mentioned, at that time he was still a captain, König. K-O-E-N-I-G, a very polished and elegant university professor. In contrast, I say that to the commandant of the army outfit.
Who was that?
Heigl. I don't remember his first name. H-E-I-G-E-L. Who, Michael, was about as anti-intellectual. And of all the things, to have that kind of enlisted personnel. While in the Air Force, I was wearing civvies within a month because I had to deal with so many people of higher rank and all that it was just an understanding. See? that we could operate
was,
this way.
Was his office, this Koenig's office, was that on in Peenemünde West on the Air Force
no,
side?
No,
or was
this
it
was,
east?
Oh yeah, this was, as a matter of fact, in the main administrative building. Mm-hmm. See, because he was a highly respected man and part of the outfit, since mm-hmm. all of his personnel was strictly working for Peenemünde East. Mm-hmm. It was a separate, or there may have been a few in West, I can't judge that.
Mm-hmm. See? But you didn't have much to do with West then?
No, we didn't have anything, except maybe for some technical reason that someone had mm-hmm. some reason. But for my functional point of view, there was nothing.
Yeah.
You turn off for a minute, I need to go.
So you said you had one more comment.
Well,
mm-hmm.
about September, October of 1943, I was called by the first sergeant. And while I was, of course, officially still designated, but I was in Anklam. And he said, tomorrow morning at 10 or so, in uniform, see the commandant. You know, as a soldier, you say, what the hell did I do? Well, the long and the short, that morning we saluted and he said, please, gentlemen, please sit down. And we said, can't be too bad today. Well, the long and the short, Mike, he said, gentlemen, I cannot give you a raise in view of your work in recent weeks and months, especially during the air raid, but I am at least authorized to promote you ahead of your time. And I ended up being the youngest sergeant, but he was really the polished professional, and that in itself we had very little contact directly with him,
mm-hmm.
but it was an intellectual climate that he created where you felt sure you did your duty still as a soldier.
Mm-hmm.
But we have no big barracks duty and all this stuff,
mm-hmm.
see?
Yeah.
So, because, you know, those of us especially, well, all of us, in essence, do air raid and all, the hours were not counted anymore. You just did the job,
mm-hmm.
see? So it was the first experience of an unusual way in a comprehensive, maybe later on called project management, whatever.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that wasn't so much worried about the formalities of the military hierarchy.
As a matter of fact, Michael, I have mm-hmm. later, in retrospect, called the air raid almost a blessing in disguise. Because the things that up to that point were, administratively speaking, a hang-up to us, were simply eradicated.
Mm-hmm. Such as what kinds of
even primitive supply problems. Like, you can't have this and this. There were no questions asked anymore.
Mm-hmm.
See, the priorities to get these labs going again would just override any of the traditional thinking. See, we still had, I even remember names, the traditional Army warrant officers, the administrative officers, not the field type. But they were even had the name Zahlmeister and Oberzahlmeister, mm-hmm. all related to money. But they were still controlling supply systems and all this. And they came out of a tradition that you couldn't blame them for.
Mm-hmm. It was the old Prussian army tradition.
Well, and to say, look, mm-hmm. to really question everything. Why do you need this?
Mm-hmm.
When in reality, the mission is what counts. Hell, he is only a channel, a funnel, see? And the craziest thing is, later on, whether in Fort Bliss or in Huntsville, I ran into the same damn problem.
Mm-hmm.
See?
It was the interface between the sort of the,
yeah.
the civilian
scientific and we get to this later in the interview, and this is how part mm-hmm. of my work in organizational communication started.
Mm-hmm.
See?
So as far as you were concerned, when you first started there, the problems mostly stemmed from sort of the old Army supply system that existed
yeah.
in Peenemünde
See,
East?
Yeah, Mike. Mm-hmm. T. Peenemünde, of course, was still fairly young, even then.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, there is, even in industry, a comparison. When you have a very advanced type of mission, especially on a product or an idea that hasn't been tackled before, why should you superimpose a traditional support system? It is more than administration. Even the personnel people mm-hmm. argue with you. This is the kind of job description, no, because it hasn't been done before. So you see, that is part of the problem, and this is why I later on explained that I was in no man's land. By understanding the needs and accepting them without hesitation, I saw the unusual type of work, not having an understanding for the technology. I just knew and then to try to persuade, to cajole, and really get things going. As mm-hmm. von Braun used to call it, greasing the skids. Mm-hmm. And that was where I learned so quickly. And mm-hmm. again, my intuition, whatever, helped a great deal. See? And then maybe, since I never really get mad, even those days, there was something you can handle by knowing the people, being respectful, and still get the job done, you know. And mm-hmm. so they suddenly say, hey, what's this kid?
Yeah, try to talk them into giving in and giving you what you want.
Remember the old definition for diplomacy, the art of letting someone else have your own way? Oh, yeah.
But, so when you came there, did you have much contact with Anna von Braun or anyone higher up? Just immediately, only when you met Thiel?
You see, when you envision... Klaus Riedel, mm-hmm. soon after we arrived, there three of us came in this same group. He invited us for a Sunday in his home. Mm-hmm. And we got to know him better. Unfortunately, as you well know, he died wrapping his American-built sports car, mm-hmm. or some sports car around a tree, you know.
Yeah, in 40, middle 44.
Yeah. But, no, you see, even our directorate, of which Connie Dannenberg was the deputy at the top, this included the valve laboratory and material testing. That was a directorate of more than 600 people total, of which we were two key units. So at the most, at my level, and especially in view of the ongoing, the coming air raid, you didn't meet many people. Because you really had, I remember, you might say, my counterparts at the directorate level, responsible for support services, they too were a pain in the neck. So they too, I don't think, ever really understood the importance of the mission, not the details of the mission technically, but to realize this is a one-of-a-kind thing that has never been done, and it deserves one-of-a-kind treatment in support services. See?
Mm-hmm. I find were those civilians too? Or?
Yeah, they were. Well, mm-hmm. They may have been just soldiers like I, assigned. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But basically, there was no hierarchy, a military hierarchy.
Mm-hmm. Most of the people didn't wear uniforms.
No. See, that lab, the directorate, had no, mm-hmm. let's say, an officer responsible. The responsible director was Walter Riedel. This was Walter Riedel II.
Number three, right? There was Klaus Riedel was two.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And yeah. Second,
you're right.
The second
Walter Riedel the third.
Right.
Yeah, see?
It's confusing.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
I'm confused here. You were under Thiel and before he was killed in the air raid. And
no.
Propulsion and testing.
Thiel was merely the man who made a choice with the commandant when new soldiers arrived as to where the assignment would be, depending on certain needs. But the director, see, Thiel was the deputy of the whole shoot and match, of the technical side. Mm-hmm. But then the directorate to which my lab belonged was under Riedel III. Mm-hmm. See? So that was in a functional, the test area was a totally different thing with Heimburg and Hüder and such people, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And, okay, so then you were transferred. Oh, I had one more question about this. As far as the Luftwaffe Army relations were concerned, as far as you were concerned, it wasn't a problem at all. There was a non-problem. You were just integrated into the organization, and there was Army people and Luftwaffe people, and nobody paid any attention to that. Is that more or less the way it worked?
Yeah. I mean, maybe at a higher administrative level, but my immediate functional concern to get the lab going again, especially after the air raid, there wouldn't be any problem whatsoever, see? Except for still formally belonging to the military unit as a soldier, see? Mm-hmm. Michael, we jump a little because it's a very closely related topic. The conditions, especially on the army side of the military unit, got so bad that in February of 1944, several hundred, I don't know the number anymore, but several hundred army VKN, soldiers were discharged and made civilian employees because this Major Heigl and his so-called top sergeant. See, there were no other officers. Every company had sort of a top kick who was totally anti-intellectual. Maybe he picked
these
them
were old
way.
NCO types.
Could be even reserve people. Mm-hmm. See, but the conditions got so bad that Walter Dornberger pushed through a rule, and even I was discharged. We were transferred formally to the Army Command for about 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. I even changed uniform. Hmm. And in February of 1944, several hundred of us were discharged. An informal discharge from the military services of Germany, mm-hmm. and became civilians.
And you became civilian employees of the Army Ordnance Office, probably?
Yeah, at that time, it may have been still called Peenemünde or even Karlshagen, mm-hmm. the cover name, see?
Yeah.
But in any case, at that time, and this is one item as a healthy young man, I sure had to explain to the American forces, they say, wait a minute, this is a fake. You were healthy. Why the hell were you discharged? Mm-hmm. Nobody believed that. Mm-hmm. Everybody said, it was over there.
Mm-hmm. So you think it was basically Dornberger's doing that resulted in that discharge?
He was, to me, for my knowledge, the key. Mm-hmm. Because it was, see, we were in such a relatively elegant situation mm-hmm. in the Air Force outfit. But in the Army, they had, give you an example, one company almost existing solely composed of PhDs and master's levels. Mm-hmm. They were so hated by their own commanders. They would be even addressing them, oh, you brains, this sort of language. Mm-hmm. It was the most anti-intellectual. And this was part of the reason, because the work load and the expectations were such that the last thing you needed was this kind of climate.
Right. You worked 12 hours a day.
It was certainly an unusual step mm-hmm. at the height mm-hmm. Almost the end of the war. Only a year to go, virtually. See? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Your transfer from Luftwaffe to Army, that is temporary, do you think that was just a bureaucratic maneuver
to get
you out?
Had to be, because the Luftwaffe mm-hmm. people could not be discharged. Mm-hmm. It was strictly an Army order. Mm-hmm. So I never forget, because I was the ranking NCO, and this small outfit that came from the Air Force then for this 2 or 3 weeks, I had to report this outfit to Major Heigl. And he touched my jacket and said, well, I guess, Sergeant, we are now taking off this beautiful coat. He was even envious mm-hmm. that the Air Force had better looking uniform. The guy was a psycho from the beginning. He was a primitive public school teacher from Pomerania, was a reserve officer, mm-hmm. who was the big cheese, almost like a TV character today, you know. And you will like it.
Did Falkion still exist after that point? Is there still some kind of organization left?
I don't know for sure, but mm-hmm. I know that not all of them were discharged. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure.
Probably anymore. Sounded like See, some of some Mike, skeleton left.
Michael, even mm-hmm. by the spring of 44, so many things had happened that you couldn't call it a disintegration. But the priorities were so clearly evolving that all these administrative matters didn't matter anymore.
More and more. Things became more and more ad hoc. You just sort of did what you
played
wanted.
Played it by ear, you know, mm-hmm. and met the demand. Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that's...
I'll give you an idea, even about the growing logistics problems. I mentioned earlier the kind of gaskets and stuff, because in the valve development, those days, even today, look how often you hear at the Cape, a valve is stuck or something. This is still a tricky area of rocketry. But even to get, let's say, a newly developed material, and to get 12 sample gaskets, I would send 2 couriers across Germany. There was mm-hmm. no reliability in the mail system, in the rail system, as shipping. And those 2 couriers, soldiers assigned to me, were simply going for the stuff and coming back. Mm-hmm. Maybe even splitting it up between them. It was that crazy, due to air raids and what have you. People are astonished when they hear this kind of nitpick and detail that you had to cope with. See? Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
So you were, when you were in Anklam, you were sort of under Lindenmeyer.
Again, oh yeah,
right?
Sure.
You were just sort of like the organizer, the administrative officer. Yeah. Left him to deal with the technical problems.
Yeah, sure. See, Mike, housing was virtually non-existent in Antlam, so we even, to a modest degree, remodeled barracks for the people. We had to have our own kitchen. Mm-hmm. It was nothing. See, so it was even then a very improvised life, and with more nearly 2 years to go in the war. See, but even then, when our oldest was born in Antlam, Monica, and Erika was living outside of Antlam, in a one-room flat, in the home of a manager of a big estate. See, mm-hmm. So there too, it was a.
That was your wife was living with.
Oh, yeah.
Living there.
Yeah,
and oldest, you were living in the barracks?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Our oldest was born. Well, Erika initially moved into the barracks, but the closer we got to Monica's birth, the more at ease we were by having her living outside the place.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, our oldest was born on October 23,
1944. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So you were scraping for food and things like that? I mean,
well,
did you get it?
There were rations from Peenemünde.
Yeah.
These two couriers I mentioned, this was their daily run. They were, mm-hmm. And they were organizers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Michael, I often feel that I may have lived with Hogan's Heroes when I see how we operated, you know. Pretty cool bunch of characters.
You needed those kind of guys, sort of.
Yeah, I learned a good old American term later that reminded me of my method.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very scientific method. Hang loose.
mm-hmm. So, how did you feel that the affected the organization's efficiency, this dispersion into, I mean, certainly there was a lot more of that. A lot of laboratories were sent out.
Yeah.
They were sent farther down the island, mm-hmm. Usedom, they were sent out to the mainland, and so you were no longer concentrated all in one place.
I probably would not be the best judge of that, since administratively it had less of an impact. As a matter of fact, it may have been an advantage to be forced to be independent. Technically, I could not judge it. It may well be that the individual department heads within that one laboratory of 220 had a lot more traveling to do, to go to conferences and all sorts of things. But I could not have any reliable memory of this sort of thing.
Do you remember Lindenmeyer having to drive over to, or
sure.
Peenemünde a lot, so he was away most of the time or half the time?
And by that time, we had such a well-oiled support system that he had the least concern about these things. See?
Mm-hmm.
Because I got the hang of this fairly early and had good people. See?
Mm-hmm.
My deputy was twice my age. Very reliable old accountant. See,
mm-hmm.
I left him with all the administration and stuff. And then, of course, this was all culminating in the late 1944, early 45 decision on the part of von Braun and his top civilians to move the whole outfit west.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out later that move and the way I handled my part of it was the reason why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
I had a letter from Werner von Braun by name designating me as the man responsible for moving this highly classified project into a predetermined area in central Germany. That was the text.
Mm-hmm. Now, what do you mean? Just not just your laboratories that were that in that
no,
area?
No, both. Both the two.
The two laboratories.
Oh, yeah. See, what was then designated as Peenemünde or Karlshagen Seen.
Mm-hmm.
See, that was Karlshagen Seen. And my orders were to move Karlshagen Seen.
Mm-hmm.
So the result, by about the 10th of February 1945,
mm-hmm.
our train moved with 54 freight cars, both labs, completely dismantled. The workforce of the two labs were about 350. Now, they did not all go on this train, because there were still a few private cars, A few were still looking for their families, but the key to it was there was not one person wanting to stay or go to the East. And then we had about 240 women and children in four Pullman-type cars, but no sleepers, just the regular passenger cars.
Mm-hmm.
And it took us 5 days, five long days, through the air raids and being in marshalling yards under air raids and all this, to get to a place called Leutenberg,
mm-hmm.
Leutenberg, in Thuringen.
Mm-hmm. Now, the date again was February?
Well, I moved this train around the 10th of February, 1945.
Okay.
As a result of this order.
Mm-hmm. And somewhere about the 15th, you reached Thuringen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And where was that in relationship to the, you know, the center was, of course, around Middelwerk.
Yeah. This was pretty, by German distances, even fairly far removed, mm-hmm. because it was only about 10 kilometers or 10 miles north of the Bavarian border.
Mm-hmm. So were you down near Coburg or somewhere?
No,
down there?
The principal city was Saalfeld.
Saalfeld,
yeah.
Okay.
That was the county seat,
mm-hmm.
see? And it was very near something that I didn't even know existed, Leesten. You
yeah.
heard that name?
Yeah.
I found out later that Peenemünde had an operation there.
Yeah, that was the... actually, I think it was a branch of Middelwerk, but anyway, there was the...
Well, it was initially...
Engine testing.
Yeah, engine testing.
See? Yeah.
Similar to White Sands, where the natural formation, the rock formation, was used mm-hmm. at the chute mm-hmm. for the flames and the water. See?
Mm-hmm.
But there was no relation except that Karl Hamburg came frequently through Leutenberg, and I wondered at first why, and then I realized he was really the titular head over Leesten as the man for the test stand, see?
Mm-hmm.
But I settled, we had taken a completely dismantled barrack system because mm-hmm. the material testing people had lived in barracks and had their labs. We took this whole barrack system down there, and we were able to unload our freight train,
mm-hmm.
and we had enough barracks and tents to protect our valuable precision machine tools and all this.
Mm-hmm. So they had sort of they had prefab barracks that could be taken down and
yeah,
reconstructed.
In a sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. But you see, there was no more work to be done. There was no facility. We located our whole storage operation on a soccer field. And by bringing the people, we live, most of the people, in triple deckers, even in the city hall assembly room. In other words, in that little old place, Michael, if I remember correctly, the initial population, regular population, would be about 1,500. And they already had 1,600 additional refugees by the time we arrived.
Mm-hmm.
See, so we just existed. And so there was no more work to be done. And the first American contact directly related to our mission was a Major Robert Staver, S-T-A-V-E-R, later on Stanford professor.
Mm-hmm.
And Bob Staver came about 48 hours after the combat troops. The combat troops came through Leutenberg on April 13, 1945. And Bob came, looked for me. He had my name, no idea from where. But this was the first official contact, and I wouldn't say we were under protection, so to speak, but we had an entirely different relationship mm-hmm. in terms of the contact with combat troops and all, see? You have questions?
Yeah, I do have questions. Since this is a good place to stop,
yeah, sure.
Because I have to turn the mm-hmm. tape over.